I feel the end of the semester fever at hand. So we have a couple of colleagues still getting their thing. Do we have quorum without
yes.
them since it's
yes.
an approval of meeting? Okay. I'd like a motion to approve the agenda as it stands in front of you. And a second. Thank you very much. All in favor? Any opposed? And any abstentions? And now let me explain something to you. The little piece of paper you're holding is not, as I said earlier, a piece of the Mueller report that we all have a little part of. Although I think we could get some notoriety as a university if we had something like that. This is the Attorney General is being a little persistent about Open Meetings Act. So this is now a recorded record of how you vote on even mundane items such as an approval of the agenda. And I said to my team, did you really have to start this on my last faculty senate meeting that I'm doing? And they said yes. So could you please circle whatever response you just gave to me under item one, and the items on your ballot will correspond to the numbers on the agenda. Is that correct, Rick? Did I do that well?
Yes.
All right. You know, for these sort of things, I got to turn elsewhere for help.
Before that, I have to get
this is, yeah. We're not in the 21st century, people, though.
Maybe you could punch these and have, like, bats or something.
They came up hanging jazz. That's it.
Yeah.
This was our team's best effort on 24 hours notice. So this is what we're doing today. On the way out, no matter when you slink out early or leave on time, please leave this with who?
There'll be two gray plastic bins, and then Dennis is going to come up and help collect.
I'm so sorry. More things to do. And before we do the meeting minutes, we have two serious and actually not happy things to take care of right now. So Senator John Burke from Gallup will be presenting a posthumous degree request for a Chantel R. Howard, who is a student in the College of Liberal Arts. So, John, I turn it over to you.
The brief statement is up here. The fast summary was that this young lady was about 20 hours short of completing her degree. Unfortunately, first sentence, the second paragraph, says a lot.
Right.
Our faculty assembly voted unanimously with very little, if any, discussion on this issue at our campus last 2 weeks ago. So we're bringing it to your attention, please.
Was this in Gallup at the accident?
Yeah, that was not very far away.
I'm so sorry to hear that. Were you one of her teachers?
Neither one of us were her direct instructors.
Did you neither one of you were?
Yeah.
Did you have any stories you wanted to share that you'd heard from others? Or?
I wish I could.
Okay, neither. You said she wanted to join. It sounded like an interesting program. What was it?
She wanted. She was thinking about going after Gallup, going for her master's in education, and wanted to teach locally.
Oh,
you know, not leave.
Right.
She wanted to stay. Stay there. So this is one little thing I think we can do.
Oh, well, I have a motion from you all to grant a posthumous degree to Chantel R. Howard. I'd like a second from the body, please. Thank you. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Any abstentions? And now I must ask you to mark your ballot. I'm sorry to put levity, you know, into something so serious, but it's kind of impossible. All right. Thank you both for presenting on her behalf. So now I have a second one, and this is a lot. You know, we've only had about one all year, so to have two in one meeting. I hope I'm not interrupting you. I still think we need full attention to Sasha's degree, Cheryl. Sorry, I could call you out. We're having a serious discussion. Posthumous degree request for Miera. Could someone present her name? Miera Martinez and Lisa Lindquist from the Office of the Dean of Students will present.
Good afternoon. I'm representing the Anderson School of Management. Miera was 15 hours from graduation this year. I met with her aunt earlier, or actually right after her passing, late last week. Her family's very hopeful that a posthumous degree can be awarded in her honor. They would like to come and at least sit through the graduation ceremony and know that they're going to get her diploma with the rest of her graduating class. Her unfortunate passing happened due to complications with diabetes.
And you were not her instructor, obviously.
Her instructor.
Did you have anything you wanted to share?
I did meet with her aunt, and she had some really nice things to say. Of course, obviously, very and unexpected circumstances on the part of the family, and so I think she's just very, in fact, she emailed me today and was like, any news yet? Any news yet? Oh, so they're very anxious. If we're able to get through this today, then we'll be on track for her to, for this to be seen in the next few phases.
And would she make it by the May graduation date?
We're going to try.
We're on that. Yeah, this is very close, I understand.
Okay, so you are presenting. Well, I actually need a motion from the body since this is not a second.
So
thank you very much. A second?
Second.
Great. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Any abstentions? Thank you. Please mark your ballot.
Is that number three?
That's number three.
Yes.
Yeah, they correspond to the numbers on this sheet, Arlene.
Yeah.
I have a question.
Yes, please.
What's her? Because her name is spelled differently on here than on here. Is her name Mireya or Mireya? We should respect her name as well. So.
How is it spelled differently? I'm sorry. I don't know.
Yeah, we actually have some problems with that ourselves, going back and forth.
Okay, so we will re-correct it here. Thanks for catching that, Bobbin. All right, so that's our third ballot. I just want everyone to keep up on that. And now the fourth one, I need a motion to approve the March 26th meeting minutes. Thank you. Second? All in favor? Aye. Any opposed? Any abstentions? Okay, please mark your ballot. If nothing else, this will keep you awake. If anyone came in late and don't know what I'm joking about, let me... talk to me afterwards. There's a ballot we're filling out that you need to get to us at the end. Okay. How are we doing on time? Are we pretty good?
3:15.
Okay. So, you know, in my report today, mostly I'd like to talk to you about the budget summit that we just held the other day. So as you know, the BLT, the Budget Leadership Team, has been meeting for the whole year and has come up with strategies to look for money for the holes we've had. It was about $10 million this year. And during that period, the legislative session occurred and the legislators asked that we would get a 4% raise. But they only, and pardon me if I repeated some of this, you know, in the past, but I think it lays the groundwork. They had given us enough to cover a 2% raise. So they give us 50 cents on the dollar. Basically, they don't, they only fund ING salaries. So that's not including many staff and many faculty. So we, as the BLT, had just assumed, well, it'll be a 2% raise because that's what we could afford. So at our last meeting before we were to present, President Stokes came and she actually asked, she said, well, you know, how heartily did you weigh the compensation fact? And it was quiet. And I said, I guess maybe a little disrespectfully, I said, well, I think we rolled over on it. You know, we just assume that we will only get 2% and we don't tend to shoot higher. And she didn't like that idea. You know, she said, well, gosh, you know, I'm concerned about compensation for you all, as are we. So at the next Board of Regents meeting, which was about 2 weeks ago, forgive me on the dates, I posed the question, what would it look like if fuller compensation were on the table initially? If that was a priority, how would that shape our conversations internally and externally? How would we approach things? Like anything in your life, you know, if you make it a priority. If I practice in the morning, I get it done. If it's not a priority, I go to a meeting, right? I mean, it is, in my life, it's that simple. So I kind of was hoping it would be that simple in a university as well. They listened to the conversation. I thought that was useful. And I was kind of plugging the idea that anything we envision can become possible and anything we don't does not become possible. So after that, the next step was the governor sent a letter to Kate O'Neill, the Secretary of Higher Education, sort of demanding. I don't know if it's a mandate. I'm not coming up with the right words, but saying everyone shall get a 4%. And I believe the word shall is, in legal terms, a necessity, right? Not as in if you feel like it or if you have money. This presented a problem for the BLT. We had come up with many scenarios, and that was not one of them. So we met again and had voted on, along with the students, a 3% increase, which did give a bit of a tuition increase, because our first scenario had no tuition increase, but some increase to upper-level division courses, and kind of held the undergraduate harmless. So this new scenario changed the fee structure a little more and had a tuition increase. And we voted unanimously on it. So we showed up yesterday at a budget meeting that was about 3.5 hours long. and the regents were there, and it was really one of the most interesting discussions I've been at. There was a little bit of contention, but done very well. It was led by Regent Sanchez Royal, and Regent Doug Brown was on the telephone. He was, so he couldn't lead it properly, but he was, all were present and accounted for. I think if you were there, you would know, so I don't feel it's talking out of school to tell you. It's a public meeting. She and Doug Brown, and even, I think, Regent Begay were leaning toward a scenario they had crafted that was not amongst our possibilities, which was called 2 plus 2. 2% this July, and 2%, I'm going to be a little sarcastic now, if pigs fly in January and somebody feels like giving us more money. That's how I looked at it. Now, maybe there was an in, and we were definitely going to get it. There was some talk that the governor had been consulted, and I did say, really out of fairness, and also because Robin Marin kept giving me kind of funny looks, you know, we spent a great deal of the last 3 years being annoyed at Regents for interference from, as we call it, the fourth floor, where the governor is residing. And I said, look, it's great that this governor's on our side, but we have to be very careful that we're getting edicts from a governor's office no matter who's in power. And Sandra Begay really understood that. She was nodding. So you'll find this funny, but Rob and Marin were voting for the 3%, which is what we did. And Rob Schwartz, great advocate for the faculty, I believe he's probably as close as we're going to get to a faculty regent right now. He is still a part-time faculty. He just said, why don't we trust the budget leadership team? They've spent time doing this. They put effort into this. Let's do what they're saying. And he agreed with the student leader and myself, Becca Myers, from ASUNM, was very well spoken, that basically a bird in the hand is worth, you know, two in the wherever Netherlands of supplemental asking. What if oil is down? What if nothing's there? So they took another vote. Their initial proposal was voted down, and then this one was put forward. And I have to say, I really think that speaks a lot to this Board of Regents, to the fact that even two of them changed their vote. Regent Brown and Regent Begay changed their vote to the one they could see was the favored by the people who'd spent a lot of time in it. And not to malign Regent Sanchez Royal, she was doing it in the best interest of the students. She said, I don't want to raise tuition. So she had that. No one had a malevolent attitude. It felt like one of the most productive Regents meetings I've been to. And I really want to thank all of us for that, because I think the work we've done over the last years, kind of corralling what we perceive to be misbehavior, has something to do with it. I want to also congratulate President Stokes, because I think they have a lot of respect for her, and I think that all these factors have come together. And so I think where we have a lot of change right now at the university, you know, we have an unknown provost, we have an unknown diversity person, a VP for finance. I think five of our deans are not going to be deans next year. They're either retiring or getting jobs elsewhere. We have stability in President Stokes and in a Board of Regents that I think is useful. And I feel like in a very good faculty senate as well. And I guess here, so let me quickly segue to something, and then if I have anything salient to say, this, you'll have to indulge me for 1 minute or maybe two, because you know I can't talk as slowly as I think. I just want to thank you. This is my fourth year as Faculty Senate President, and it's been about 6 years involved in it, because there was a year on and off in between, and it's really been one of the greatest honors of my life, and one of the hardest things I've ever done. But I've learned so much about our colleges and our departments, and oh God, am I going to cry? That's going to be so weird. I did not anticipate that. Okay, I'm going to put my glasses on, because when you look like a nerd, you cannot cry. Okay, so I did write a few things. You know, I've learned so much about our colleges, all you do in your departments, you people, and how lucky the state is to have each and every one of us and this particular faculty at this particular institution. I've enjoyed getting to brag about you and do my best to protect our mission when necessary and with the help of my team, and to be a part of defining to the state just who we are and what we do here that makes UNM such a special place. I'd like to acknowledge my current team, Jason, Nancy, Jeff, Randy, Rob, and Finney. And I'd also like to acknowledge my team that was with me for almost 3 years, Coffee Brown, Lee Brown, Marique and Shainer, who we lost to San Diego State, along with Hector. There must be something going on in California. Tiffany Lee. Yeah, it's called a beach. And the ocean. And I'm not going to say anything about salaries. No. Tiffany Lee and Loic Traxler. Nothing gets done without a team, and I couldn't have done it with all of them. So thank you for indulging me in that.
You're here.
I think, yeah, we've done a lot of good things this year. I mean, I remember when we pulled together to, before we knew that Garnet Stokes would be a wonderful president, so you weren't in the offing, so it's no slight to you. This group
had a 92% vote on retaining Shawi Abdallah. And the only, I don't care what the vote was, but the fact that 92% of us participated in that vote is really telling. The fact that Rob Doty said when we were looking for a president, we are going to do whatever the faculty wants, had to do with our persistence. So I really, and not to mention things like Regent Adopted College program and the Academics Within Borders program and the faculty focus. I think the best thing we did really was the governmental relations capital outlay that got $88,000 for the College of Pharmacy. And this year, $160,000 for the art department. And it wasn't vetoed. I'm sorry. When you get vetoed year after year, getting not vetoed is kind of a big deal. Okay, so thank you for all that. Now, let me just quickly see things that are more important to you all than me reviving my own life. I'm thinking about the future. So what do we need to be focusing on? The redesign effort. Could you just pull that up for me? Provost Wood will not be here today, but Pamela Cheek is in his stead. She'll speak later. But he had encouraged me to look at this and see how people might feel about going and being a part of this. Could you pull up, let's say, Task Force 1? You can find this on his webpage. Okay, so you don't need me to read that for you, but you get the point, right? So there are six of these. For some reason, there's a seventh one up there, Pamela. I don't know if you know the answer, but there's nothing under it, so I'm not sure. I imagine that these will tie directly into President Stokes' strategic plan and our new provost. So I would say some of these task force, by the way, are quite old. Some of the people on it have graduated or are leaving university, so I'm guessing that there needs to be an update on these. But keep your eye on what I'm basically telling you, even though I'll be here next year as past president, is things to look for in the future. We'll have a provost announcement hopefully soon, as well as the SVP for Finance and the Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion. Later on in the session today, I'm bringing Bob Behrens, Chair of Economics, to talk about budget models. This is extremely important. And right now we're considering a new budget model, which is not really new. People have been using it for years, where there's a centralized model for tuition and also some funnels down to departments as they use innovative and creative strategies. And they're implementing this in College of A&S. That's their idea, to see how it works at others. So in other words, the old tricks are not working. And aside from begging for more money all the time, we need to be creative. Another way I'd like us to come together, I'm on another committee led by Julie Coonrod and then another with Terry on enrollment management. How do we increase this? I am convinced that the key lies with us as faculty. I mean, I have my glorious idea, like Academic Borders. It'll probably take another 10 years to get it out. But that faculty tour the world, a group of faculty from different departments that can rotate, and set up camp in Beijing for a week or wherever it is, and create a pipeline that way. I know that when I taught, I was a visiting professor in China and in Brazil, that's where I get students. They don't hear about us because we're always so famous internationally. But once they come, I think they're very happy to be here. So you all will probably have better ideas on that. All right. And, oh, we did, by the way, receive $21 million in allocations this year, which is the most we've ever got in a non-bond year. So we should be pretty happy about those things. I think that's it, Pamela. Maybe when you're up here, I'll ask you the question I thought I would ask you. But that is it. Yes, okay, question.
So I just had a follow-up to Nora. The things that you mentioned in your talk. So the raise is at 2% raise?
No, three. Yeah.
Okay.
They had suggested, well, we hope when it's done, it's done. But the president can maybe answer. Yeah, we'll let her handle that one. We argued for the three. They had asked for a 2+2.
Just to make sure you get it right, because we have a faculty meeting on Thursday, and I know that everyone's going to be like, what's happening?
Well, we hope it's a three, unless the president is telling you something else. So she will say something in a minute. Any other questions? Yes, Stephanie. Okay, and then
you have a little bit more about this ballot that we're filling out. I noticed our names are on them.
Right, so it's an open meeting
act.
Rick, you want to?
The board, commission, or other policy-making body shall keep written minutes of all of its meetings. The minutes shall include the minimum of the date, time, place of the meeting, the names of the members in attendance, and those absent, the substance of the proposals considered, and a record of any decisions and votes taken that show how each member voted.
Thank you.
So that's why we're doing it. Kelsiana, what was this?
I was just going to ask, is the budget top secret?
The budget top secret?
No.
Gosh, it's everywhere.
Where's the budget?
Gosh, since I'm in the meetings, I actually don't know where it is on the web. Anyone else? Pamela?
Which budget? The whole thing?
Yeah, the one that has just been approved.
Well, the budget has not been approved.
Okay.
So I can talk about
Well, let's have the president handle this. I'm sorry, I forgot a very important thank you. We could not have done anything without Kennedy, who's in an NAF&T meeting right now, and Rick Holmes, so I'm going to embarrass you by giving you flowers. Jason, give me your agenda.
My right-hand man. Okay, President Sykes, we're up for you. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. Well, good afternoon, everyone. I will sit here, happy to be here. I had the pleasure of meeting one of Kennedy's daughters today. I will tell you, in my first time as a university administrator, I have gone to schools and been in school in children's classrooms, but it was the first time in my career that I went to a school assembly. I'll admit, it turns out I really don't know how to control first graders. It was amazing, but Kennedy's daughter was among them, so I feel like I was going to meet a lot of Lobos. We had Louie and Lucy there. They were all very excited. I found out I was meeting actually the children of many parents who work at UNM in one form or another, and so that's really a highlight. One thing about this time of year, there's a lot of great things that do happen. I did want to spend a little time on the compensation, and I think Pamela has described described this quite well. The thing that is confusing to many is the process that we had involves going to the regents to ask for approval of really three things. The tuition and fee increases, and then the compensation increase. And what happens then is we have to have approval for that before we can actually develop the budget that is then formally approved at the next regents meeting. What's a little odd about our system, and I think it must happen in those years when it's a 60-day session, we are required to turn in a budget on May 1st. And it requires budget offices on the health sciences side and the main campus side to really pull together a massive amount of information for submission to the higher education department by May 1st. But it's not actually formally approved until the next regents meeting, which is May 9th. So things can change, but the formal approval for that full budget will be at that point. And so that, the question about where it is, there are no secrets that should all be actually posted. It'll all be shown and presented at the regents meeting, and at the very least, a place where you can always find it would be in the minutes from regents meetings that are focused on approval of budgets. One thing I discovered is that we used to keep this budget information on our Sunshine portal, whatever that is, but I found out, I'm not sure we're clearly posting it there regularly. I found that out when one of our new regents was looking for information this weekend and found, on the Sunshine portal information from 2015. But then I was told, well, it's always going to be in the regents minutes. So that is a place where, you will find the detail. In fact, when I was interviewing provost candidates, they were shocked by the level of detail available in the minutes for regents meetings. And one of the candidates had gone through and read, years of regents meetings. So some of the interactions that took place at regents meetings are documented. And so they were able to ask questions about what is the climate here. It sounds like there's a lot that happens. But I thought you'd appreciate that, because I certainly did. But for future reference, there's just a lot of information.
Be careful what you say.
It has been an interesting year. I mean, we went into this budget cycle. The budget leadership team's been meeting since September. Of course, there's another process that takes place on the health sciences side, even though we do have health sciences representation on the budget leadership team. But we had interim leaders as, well, not initially, but we ended up with interim leaders as co-chairs. And I've come to realize that it's a very good process that we have. But I think Pamela described well a concern that, I had made a presentation to Regents in the fall about compensation and have, obviously been concerned that there have been years without it, and I hear about that from a lot of quarters. So we were going to go through with that 2-2, and I had said that we would with a 2% is really what we were going to go up with. It was a 2%
initially.
Right. And then we got the letter that said that changed the interpretation of how we were supposed to calculate raises. Now, when I say 2%, I don't mean to suggest that across the board at the whole university it was going to be 2%. We had already agreed that the School of Medicine would have a 3% raise, and so everything else was going to be 2. We were going to have a 3% in School of Medicine, and then we were going to have the option, which is what we've done in the past, which makes me a little ill, and I believe we have to change this, that units that had the resources could give raises that were higher. And what that has created, of course, are places where there was a little more competitiveness for our market rates, and some, not to imply that we're at market rates in a lot of places. We know we have challenges, health sciences and main campus as well. And that, I've become very much aware of that issue. But that's what we were going to do. And then we got this little line through something on compensation from the governor that we spent. It came out on a Friday. Our budget summit was Monday, Tuesday. And we got confirmation on Monday that the meeting was, yes, we expect you to get 4% raises across all your employees. And so New Mexico State had already approved their decisions. They were actually in their Board of Regents meeting when this came out from the governor. They were already going to raise tuition 6%. So we get this clarification. I realize a 4% across the board, we are not funded for that. And so in that budget summit meeting, I presented kind of what we could quickly figure out was the gap. And what I calculated was that that what it costs to give a 4% across the board to everyone at the University of New Mexico was just shy of $30 million. And what the state had provided to us in the form of compensation for these raises was less than $10 million. Now, what I heard was that immediately, well, one thing I'd been hearing, I'd heard it said before at state government, was that, well, you've got all those people on contracts and grants, that's all been budgeted, so that, you're wrong about what proportion is actually covered. You got a lot of people that will be covered on those contracts and grants. Well, I know, and I believe I shared this in the budget summit meeting that took place a couple of weeks ago, but I don't know how many of you hear that or saw that, so I'm repeating myself, hopefully not too much for those who've seen all this more than once. I just went ahead and assumed that the contracts and grants component made up about $4 million of that total. It was just shy of $4 million, and that it would be fully funded, but I shared with the Regents that that actually wasn't true. Most contracts and grants don't have budgeted a 4% increase. They usually have some average every year that's less than that. Some contracts and grants don't allow for this, and so it really depends on the funding source, etc. But knowing that we were going to get hit with, well, you're just exaggerating what the real cost is, I went ahead and took that off, and then we were left with about $16.6 million. I later heard that, and this was a true statement, it's just I didn't have the ability to calculate it with a day's notice, but I did end up sharing it with the board yesterday. And this is a true. This was true. The governor said, "You're exaggerating the amount. You were actually going to give larger raises than the 2%. And so you had more money to put into this pot than you had shared. So I got that. I knew that that was true, and I got those figures. It turned out that $16.6 million didn't take into account that the School of Medicine was giving a 3%, so there's some extra money. And then there were those variations in health sciences, and with fewer variations on the main campus, of some additional funding being put toward raises. So in the end, the gap was about $10 million. Okay, not 16.6. $10 million recurring dollars is still a lot of money. And I believed that it was an opportunity to really go back and say, let's do better than we were going to do. But when it came down to it, to fund a 4% raise would have required a 6% tuition increase. And I will be upfront with you, New Mexico Tech went in and told their students we'll have a 6% tuition increase. My advice in talking to some leadership for the Council of Presidents was that we really had received kind of a mandate, perhaps, and a deficient funding scenario, basically, for these raises. And so, in the end, my strategy, I hoped, was that we would see if we could get to the 3%, which, if we could, would guarantee that we would have this 3% for all of our faculty and staff. And the budget leadership team approved this with a tuition increase. And then we're going to make the ask for a deficiency in funding that's been provided for providing the 4% across the board that the governor has recommended. So the whole entire Council of Presidents intends to go and make our case for this deficiency of funding. We also spent a lot of time this year trying to convince the legislature that they're using the wrong formula for giving us our raise pools. And so we hope to get some traction with that, especially with what's happened here in this next legislative session. But it's hard to say. I sat in a meeting of the presidents of the 2 and 4 year universities last week, and someone from the Legislative Finance Committee was there saying that the governor had mandated the 6% for public education and 4% for higher education. And I was able to ask the question of what proportion of that was the state actually funding. And well, it's greater than 90% for public education. But for higher education, because of the ways in which our campuses are so much more complex, they're just funding it on the I&G state-funded portion of the allocation. And this year, there was even a mistake made where they didn't account for the 2% that we had received last year. So we've got to go in and make a correction, even in some of that. And this is apparently what happens every year, but these are interesting things to discover about our process. The concern about, you know, is it going to be 3%? Well, HED does have to approve our entire budget. I don't expect HED to fail to approve our budget just because we didn't get all the way to the 4%. I don't think that's going to happen. We actually were told that they wanted us to come and ask for that supplemental funding. But the reality is that getting that funding isn't just... It can't just be done by the governor. It is a legislative action, and so the political complexity of actually being successful there. We're actually going to go for the 1%. So that's really the plan at this point. We did the 3%, and I believed, Rich Wood is actually the one who articulated this. You know, we have two sources to fund on main campus in particular, but in some areas of sciences, two sources of funding to really give raises: state appropriations and tuition. And so this turns out to me to be a good balance in trying to do what the governor has asked: 1% via tuition and 1% from a state appropriation. So that's what we're going to be arguing for. And certainly, I'm happy to answer any additional questions about that. People ask about the provost search. I hope to make an announcement this week. I met with the Equity and Inclusion Search Committee, and I'm gathering the feedback from campus for those who participated in that process. So I'm kind of examining all of that information now. I will just say how delighted I was to have the opportunity to interview the four people who were the finalists for this position. That was a wonderful chance to get to know talent on this campus, but also the interest of people on this campus in equity and inclusion. And I think there's much that we'll be able to do. So I'm certainly not anywhere completed in my task there, but I certainly hope to digest all this information and set a course, sometime next week. We have our senior vice president candidates here. The fourth one's on campus tomorrow, and we'll move forward with that hopefully in another week and a half as well. We've launched our enrollment management search, so those are on the way. I have a town hall meeting that I've called for noon on Friday. I assume it's over in the sub. I assume it is. I'm realizing I called for it, so it's up there somewhere. But
I think it's in Ballroom C in the email.
Ballroom C, yeah. Okay. Thank you. And it'll be from 12 to 1, cookies and popcorn, and I'll address a few things, but it'll be a chance for people to ask me any questions that you'd like to. And then we have had a full faculty meeting called for next Tuesday scheduled right now from 10 to 12, and I am learning a lot about governance processes here in the faculty handbook, and so I will be the presiding officer of that meeting next Tuesday, so I'm looking forward to a lot of participation. And with that, I think I'll just quit and take any questions that you might have.
And that meeting is on the union, just to be clarified. That's what's being held by Cog and Sever as the chair.
At Pope Joy starting at 10. I think the agenda went out this afternoon, and I know that there's a sign-in process.
Get there early.
Yeah, so.
You have to show your ID to come in.
Yeah, so it's
Okay, yes.
So I just have a question because I've gotten this inquiry from several of my constituents. Because I think it was a little confusing with the governor's choice of a line item veto. Historically, and we haven't had many in my short tenure here, so I'm not very familiar with the process. The understanding was that we would get, on average, a 3% raise, which meant that, and I represent school of medicine faculty, that some people could get 4, but other people could get 2 or 1 or whatever. And then it was somewhat unclear about whether or not that option had been taken away based on a line item veto of the governor where she took out the word average. And I just want to be able to speak knowledgeably to the process if there is variation among the raise percentage that faculty gets.
So, I hope that that my understanding of all of this is accurate. But when we, as a leadership team, were deciding on raises and how it would be done, it was my understanding initially that we were expecting the language to say that we were supposed to give, on average, a 4% raise. And we have always used that language to give us leeway in what we and the decisions we were making on our campus, because we were never given sufficient funding to give whatever raise the state gave us. We were always giving less than that, usually 50% less. But my understanding is that as a leadership team, we had decided that the campus, everyone who was performing satisfactorily, was going to get the 2%, and that in the School of Medicine, assuming the same things, everyone was going to get 3. It is possible, though, that I misunderstood what the School of Medicine was going to do in that context, and that their intention was an average of 3 instead of a 3%. But I don't think that's true. I think it was supposed to be a 3%, and the variability was around the ability to give more than that if you had resources that allowed you to do that. And at the time, I had actually, the first stage, it was going to be you could give up to 5% with chancellor's approval or executive vice president approval, and above 5% would require the president's approval. When we started finding out that this was going to be different, we shifted the rules. And then, of course, it all evolved. So I believe where we are now is that it's a 3% across the board.
Unless you are, like, on a performance review something.
Yeah, there are people on some types, unless you're, and I don't know what the language is on the HSC side, but on the main campus side, I know it really has to do with being at a satisfactory performance level on our system, and then I'm sure there's something like that on the HSC side.
You just raises something, though, and I don't know if you can answer it. One of the deans brought up that there are no metrics for getting additional pay. So how is that decided? I'm wondering if that's something that needs to be a larger conversation.
So I do think that we as a university have to tackle what we mean when we talk about merit and what brings about merit pay. And we had some conversations about that. I suspect that there are variations across departments in the ways in which they assess faculty and or staff performance and then decide on merit increases. So it is a conversation for us to have as an institution. There are differences of opinion about this. We had a lot of conversation about what does it mean to do across the board and what does it mean to give merit pay. We have not had sufficient funding at the institutional level to make clear divisions and say, okay, this much is across the board and this much is merit. And so there's just a lot of variation in individual units.
Thank you. I just had a follow-up question to that. So it's a 3% raise across the board if people are at a satisfactory performance level. And what did you say was the tuition increase that compensated?
Let me be clear. 2% of the raise was covered by state appropriations. It was very close. So we were able to do the 2% across the board, and HSC was able to do the 3% in medicine with the state appropriation plus what HSC had available in the School of Medicine.
Okay.
We raised tuition 3.1% in order to fund an additional 1% in compensation.
Okay. And they were hoping.
And that was largely funding it on the main campus side. Tuition raises on the HSC side don't really, they're a really small part of the compensation package. It's just a different situation.
And we're hoping for a supplemental 1% from the next
legislation. And the hope is that we will be able to successfully get an initial 1% from the state. Frankly, I know how fraught I just know this is not. I don't think I would have used this when pigs fly kind of thing. But
that's why you're the president.
I'm not allowed to talk like that. But I know how politically difficult this could be for us to be successful.
President Stokes, so you mentioned the raise for the School of Medicine. What about, like, college pharmacy or nursing, population health that are part of the health sciences?
So my understanding is that 3% that we voted on is would include those departments.
Okay.
I'm realizing that there was so much going on during the budget meeting yesterday that I am not entirely clear what, if any, effect these decisions ended up having on the School of Medicine. So, but I believe that we agreed to a 3% for those other units as well. Paul Roth and I have talked about this, and our goal is to try to be consistent with those departments and what we do on main campus, even though I think in the past there may have been some differences, sometimes favoring one side of the campus over the other, but it's gone back and forth.
Okay.
Yes,
Al. Okay, anyone else besides Nora? Just because I feel like if only two people ask questions, that's it. But if she's the only one, go ahead, Nora.
Thank you very much. So you said that there's a meeting on Friday to discuss the union at 10 a.m.?
No.
The COG meeting is Monday. Tuesday.
So the full faculty, the the Committee on Governance has called a full faculty meeting for 10 o'clock next Tuesday. It's currently scheduled from 10 until 12. A vote, I believe, can be taken during the meeting to extend that meeting by 30 minutes, but no more. The meeting cannot last more than 2 hours and 30 minutes. And I know I'll get corrected because I've learned all these things. The Friday meeting is a town hall meeting for faculty, staff, and students from 12 to 1 in sub ballroom C.
And there's no voting there.
No, this is a town hall with me, just for people to come and get an update and ask me questions.
It just became really unclear in all of the...
I understand. I was throwing out a lot of information.
And the root beer floats are yet another event.
Well, the root... That's right. Okay, Thursday is supposed to be 80 degrees, and we're serving root beer floats between 2 and 4 o'clock at University House. So there.
Got it. So I have this, there's a page on UNM website which says MOU between UNM and US UNM. I'm not sure what that is. It talks about what the salary rates for those units are, and it says for FY19, the bargaining unit will receive 1% base salary raise. If they meet the criteria below, they may receive additional up to 2% based on merit, consistent with criteria below. Also says they receive an additional 1% to 2%.
Raj, can I ask? What unit is that?
It's US UNM. So it's up to 5%. So I'm kind of curious which unit on campus is getting 5%.
USUNM.
Yes. Staff. The union for the staff.
Dorothy Anderson and Doris Lillian, who's the president.
So, okay. I'll be honest. I don't know for sure what that is, but what I mentioned earlier was that our original plan that was sent out to budget leaders and deans and department chairs was that we were going to give a 2% across the board, but that individual units would have the latitude to give raises up to 5%, but then with president's approval above 5%. That sounds like it might be the original guidelines that were shared rather than the revised guidelines that were shared. And that came out of, and I realize that, but the rules were not going to be different for faculty on that. So, I don't believe that would any longer be applicable.
Okay.
I do want to clarify, though, that we do have some staff unions and then the hospital, and those compensation packages are separate. They're bargained separately from anything I'm sharing with you about what the board voted on yesterday. Okay?
I was just wondering, President Stokes, is there any efforts underway to clarify the budget disconnect between the legislature and UNM? Because this happens every year where there's misunderstanding of what a 2% versus 4% raise would look like.
So the Council of Presidents of the four-year universities tried to get some traction this past year on this very issue. And the reality is that there are a lot of people who don't believe us when we say that we don't have the money to cover this. And the community colleges don't have a problem with the disconnect. They have the mill levy. They have other sources of funding. So they're funded so differently that it's never a problem for them. It's only a problem for the four-year universities. And UNM is the one who was affected the most by this discrepancy between by the number of employees we have that are not funded strictly on state appropriations. So my purpose in actually being very specific about the gap and explaining where it comes from is so that they begin to believe us about what happens when they give us a so-called 4% raise. Because one of the things I hear all the time is this lack of trust in what we're telling them about resources we have or don't have. which is why I got down to the dollar figure on what the gap actually was in my presentation yesterday. So, yeah, we're trying to do that. But the reality is, a legislature is going to be reluctant to fund all aspects of the university's operations. But we're just hoping to get that percentage up to something closer to what it once was, which was closer to 60 or 70% of what we needed to actually fund raises.
Actually, Rob Doty raised an interesting point that if you had added the amount of money that they had stopped giving us, in 2009 it was at $192 million, or 94, I think, and down to, I think, we're 180-something now. But if you accumulated those over time, it would add up, his math was off by one, $144 million. Now, who's to say they could have kept that up? But it was an interesting point that he raised, that we're seriously in a deficit in terms of state expenditures. Yes.
So I had a question about whether or not there's going to be any dedicated funding for equity adjustments that account for specifically ranks within a department, because I think the traditional way that it's dealt with is there's an average that's given for the college and then adjustments are made accordingly. But I'm wondering if there's going to be a much more custom tailored approach that actually looks at ranks within departments.
That is something that we have to tackle institutionally right now. So when I approved the memo that went out, we wanted to clarify that the additional funding that was could be provided for raises could be for merit, equity, and retention, I believe is how we worded it. But frankly, those dollars exist in the individual units, and it could be that some of this is going out at the college level to individual departments, and I don't know for sure what happens with college level budgets and how they distribute the funding. So, but I know that we have to tackle this institutionally, because the issues that are raised there are very unevenly being managed because we are dependent upon unit level decision making and for assigning raises, and we don't have a centralized fund for doing it.
Great. Okay, Cheryl, yes.
Good question. You mentioned that the community colleges are funded differently than four-year universities. Do you know where the branch campuses that usually are 2 years, do they fall into the community college funding, or do they fall into the
Well, I'm a little ignorant of exactly how this works, because they do actually go to meetings that involve the two-year colleges, and they do have a separate funding source that is given to them. I don't know if it's a mill levy.
They have a mill levy.
They do. Is it the mill levy?
They do have a mill levy, and then they pay us an operating agreement percentage. It's actually quite small,
yes.
but they do have a mill levy, so they were able to accommodate the 4% on the basis of having a mill levy, pretty much the way the CNM were able.
But I'll tell you that they were very clear with me at the budget summit where I asked for a postponement. They asked for approval to go ahead with theirs, but that was largely because they were meeting with their advisory boards, and they wanted clarity going into their advisory boards meetings. They were going to have to struggle to hit the 4%, but I think their funding source, they are funded quite differently.
I was just curious as a result.
Okay. All right.
Okay, you guys, I think we have to let her go so we can keep going with the meeting. Thank you, President
Stokes. I've gone
way over. Yeah, no, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for the time.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
All right, see you.
And now we have Rich Wood is in a meet, and so he does the wonderful Pamela Cheek, one of the Associate Vice Provosts. Thank you for coming, madam.
My pleasure. Thank you, Pamela.
I know we've got. We each call each other Pamela One. So in essence, there are no Pamela Two. All right. What have you for us today?
Yes. It's a pleasure to see all of you fellow faculty. Really, I'm happy to answer questions. I'm sure that I was sort of prepped to answer some budget questions, but I think you've gotten more than enough of that. My guess is that you're interested in some of the transitions in academic affairs and what that looks like, and that you might also be interested in some of the processes that we've been trying to address and improve over the last year, and what the status of those are. And maybe I'll try to sort of be relatively brief with that kind of update, and then if you have direct questions that I can try to field, I'll do my best with them. So the big transition question, Provost Wood will be in place until July 1, and we expect, and then we expect that a new provost will take on leadership. We are working very hard within academic affairs to make sure that the transition from interim provost Wood, and then also the other transition that we're dealing with, which is associate provost for faculty development, Alex Lubin, will be going to Penn State and will be leaving us, and we're actually interviewing for a new interim associate provost for faculty development right now. We're trying to make sure that those two transitions happen very smoothly. Sometimes in the past, when academic affairs has moved between leadership teams, we haven't been as effective as we could be in making sure that basic processes and basic information handoffs happen smoothly. So again, we're putting significant effort into making sure that that handoff happens well. One of the things that is actually playing in our favor is that as a result of completing the Higher Learning Commission accreditation visit, we actually have a very robust set of data, reports, information, and processes that are pretty polished and are really, you know, there for us to just hand over to the next leadership team. And I should say that I'm fortunate in being able to continue as Associate Provost for Curriculum Assessment, and that Interim Senior Vice Provost Barbara Rodriguez will be continuing on as well. You know, again, trying to create this overlap between outgoing Associate Provost Lupin and whoever is hired as an Interim Associate Provost to replace him, so that some training can occur there. So we've got a lot of information about the university all in one place, and we feel that we're really ready to hit the ground running when a new leadership team is fully in place in academic affairs. That includes the work that's been done on the redesign process that was initiated under Provost and former President Abdullah, and that Interim Provost Wood has carried forward. So what you were shown earlier by President Quayle, the different teams that work on different areas of redesign, they've actually all submitted reports, and then the next stage has happened in which sort of groupings of teams have swapped the reports and looked at information and prioritized which kinds of things we might be able to do and we should do relatively rapidly, what sorts of things are kind of middle distance but things that nonetheless we should be doing at some point, and then what sorts of things might either not be things that we want to consider or are sort of in the far distance. So we have actually, again, ready for the incoming academic affairs team, a set of priorities that are based on very diverse faculty input. Those teams were from very different parts of campus, really different kinds of leaders, really different kinds of faculty, some student leaders in a couple of cases. I feel certain that there won't be just a, you know, put the thumb on the button, move forward, but that we will continue to work closely in consultation with faculty. The current team in academic affairs is deeply committed to working in a grassroots way rather than in a top-down way, and I don't anticipate that changing, but I don't know who the next provost will be, so we'll see how that plays out, but certainly Barbara Rodriguez and I are very committed to making sure that things are done correctly in consultation and with your faculty. So there's a structure of set of plans there. We know, because of the kinds of budgetary exigencies that were just being discussed, that we're not in a position as a university to not make some changes to how we do business. We know that higher education is changing, that our students are changing, our faculty is changing, and it would be foolhardy to try to be a 1950s institution in a 2020 world. The Higher Learning Commission visit was, as far as I know, largely successful. I think, again, in part because everyone across the university, including the branches, rallied to put together really strong information. Again, we know a lot about ourselves at this point, and we were able to demonstrate that not only had we studied ourselves consistently over the last 10 years, we had also taken action in really important areas, particularly areas related to student success and also improvement and transparency of processes. A couple of key things to kind of keep in mind as you wander around your lives here, and that useful figures to know. Our advisor to student ratio is 1 to 185. That's down from some highs of 1 to 800 in some units 10 years ago, not all units, but some units. So really quite extraordinary shift. And we're just about, as a result of what I discussed on yesterday, to implement some an extended HR study that is allowing us to streamline and make consistent advisor ranks and also pay grades and roles relative to ranks for advisors. That should, we hope, eliminate some of the competition between colleges over advisors and also further professionalize advisors. They should, for the most part, be receiving additional compensation. They're critical to what we do with students. So that was one of the things that we were able to show on the Higher Learning Commission. Our teaching faculty who are actually having contact with students, our teaching faculty to student ratio. Anybody want to take any guesses of what that is? I'm always kind of interested in this one. I gave you the tip on the advisors. It's 14 to 1. We're really good. We're really good. We're really paying attention to students. Also, you know, you all know the four-year graduation rate. We had the highest increase in four-year graduation rate amongst comparable institutions in the nation. You may not know, although folks would maybe share this with you, that our students graduate, our likelihood of students graduating and their time to graduation is about 10 percentage points higher than one might expect based on their entering achievement scores and grade point averages as you rank that against comparable achievement scores and grade point averages coming out of high school nationally. So we're doing a phenomenal job. So we should find out what the accreditation affirmation status is sometimes in the next couple of weeks here. The accreditation team left, I think, being pretty rosy. I do anticipate that we'll probably be there will be some requests for some interim reports there. And I think those would be in areas that won't be a surprise to the body.
Shared governance ones.
I would anticipate there might be something around shared governance. I would anticipate there might be something around athletics financial management, even though we were able to show that we've implemented many fail safes with respect to athletics. There might be some other areas as well. That's part of the process, and when we get one of those interim reports, what we do is we respond to it and we try to improve our processes. So what else can I tell
questions
you?
For the vice provost?
Yes, Cassano.
Enrollment.
Yeah, so built into the budget that was conditionally passed yesterday is an enrollment hedge of about 4%. So we're making sure that even if our enrollment drops again, right, we'll be protected, that we've anticipated it. And it may be that there's too large of a hedge there. It may turn out that, in fact, there will be some money that will appear because we overprotected, we overcalculated. Right now, based on the figures for new student orientation, which is one of the ways that we measure what our predicted enrollment is going to look like for the fall, we are still below where we were 2 years ago, but we are above where we were last year, significantly above. So it's not as good as it was 2 years ago, but it's much better than last year. We're hoping those trends will continue, and this, I know that you've involved in conversations about this, but also are probably also participating in measures to address enrollment concerns. I should say, too, that one of the things that we're working on out of academic
upstairs to support over a longer term ways of addressing enrollment issues is two grants that come out of the APPL, the American Public Handicap Universities, that are focused on identifying barriers to student success and how to remove those barriers to student success, including barriers that occur before students even walk in the door. And a big focus of those grants is making sure that we streamline our communication processes with students so that it's actually planned communication from high school forward. So that's an ongoing project. It takes time and some institutional maturity to pull those sorts of things off, but we hope that that will be another way of addressing some of the issues.
Emily, I'm going to have to cut you short. Any other pertinent questions? We're just running about 20 minutes late. Yes, Sarah. Bye.
The Higher Learning Commission accreditation report. Okay, so there's a couple things there. So all of the material almost all of the material that we provided to the Higher Learning Commission is available on hlc2019.unm.edu. When we receive a Higher Learning Commission affirmation of accreditation, we'll let you know, and it will be posted, as all of these things are. We don't know whether there will be a request for an interim report on a particular area. It has been the case in the past that UNM has always been requested to provide an interim report on faculty governance. So it would be tough to do if we didn't have to do that. There are other processes that are going on. General education is undergoing massive transformation. The FAR, which is the registering of faculty achievement on an annual basis, is developing further. We're trying to improve some processes relative to faculty hiring and speed with respect to faculty hiring. You'll also see some information coming out about how faculty development, my counterpart, Associate Provost Faculty Development, will be trying to integrate even further some of the advanced processes for equity and also for retention amongst underperforming faculty. So there's many, many more things we can talk about, but I know you're pressed
for time. Yes, we are pressed for time. Thank you so much for coming today. I appreciate it.
Pleasure.
Thank you. Okay, Finney.
Yes.
Committee appointment
approval. This comes as a consent item from us. Give me a second to look at this. Do you have a motion to approve?
It comes from us, so just a second. Can we give you a second?
Okay. Be number 9 on your sheet.
Right. Pull out your ballots, folks. Sorry. Are we all equal? We're all on number 9 now? All right. You want to call the question, Finney?
Yes.
So,
all
in favor?
Aye.
Thank you. Any opposed? Any abstentions? Okay, Sarah, make a note of whatever you just... Great, thank you, everyone. All right, we have one more very important, really the most important reason we're here every day, is approval of our spring 2019 degree candidates. I'm assuming you're not going to post them. They're up there if you want to read through them and make sure people have them. There is a privacy list, so there'll be some people that will not be on a general list for reasons they only know to themselves. So I would like, actually, let's do this the full way. I'd like a motion and then a second to approve the degree candidates. Thank you. Motion, second. Thank you very much. All in favor of approving our degree candidates, say aye. Thank you. Opposed? Any abstentions? All right. Now, please mark that on number 10 of your ballot. You know someone's going to get to the end and go, wait, I have one left. All right. So we're trying a new thing. All right. Thank you so much. Now, what are we on, Rick?
11 Forms C.
11 Forms C from the curriculum. Okay, a motion.
A second.
A second only. Second, me second.
Second.
Thank you. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Abstentions? Mark it on your ballot. Sorry, it's hard to multi here. That was number 11. I feel like that. What do they call it? An auction.
12.
Okay, 12. Now we have one of my colleagues, Professor Kevin Mignot. Come join us.
Hi, everybody.
It's a Form D, new graduate certificate in music performance.
It's my first time in this room. We are proposing essentially a one-year program in music performance, a certificate program, which is very much like an artist diploma, which you can find in many universities and conservatories across the country, including some of our peers. It's a 12-credit program, mostly involving performance courses with some options for academic classes if the students should choose to do so. They would get intensive additional instruction with our faculty, and a person could enter this program who's either completed a bachelor's or a master's degree. We already have a lot of interest in this program from our own students who might want to stay an additional year beyond either one of those programs, and we also see it as a way that we could recruit students internationally in the future. So we already have a lot of interest in this. It does not duplicate or overlap an existing program within UNM. The governance structure will be more or less the same as it is now. We don't anticipate additional costs for this program. And I think it's a standalone program, so the degrees would not overlap.
In the arts, I can just add on that it's common to have an apprenticeship, which means staying a little longer, and many of our students find creative ways to extend their visas. This would be an easier way of doing it, especially under current administrations, where some of our students are having problems extending their visas. So for us, this is a no-brainer, and as Kevin said, it is common. Many schools, Juilliard is one of them, has an artist diploma program. So this is akin to that, but we're calling it a certificate, right? And it will be a useful recruiting tool.
Absolutely.
And for us, that's extremely important.
Motion, please.
Thank you very much for that.
Second.
Motion, a second. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Abstentions. Please do mark that on your ballot. We need that. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you,
Kevin.
See you in
that one. Well, okay.
Have
you been here that long? Okay, Fran, come join us. You're on. And I'm sorry, Kim, the president. We had her, and she went on about 35 minutes, which is great. But so we're substantially behind. Now you do your best, Fran. Everyone knows Fran Wilkinson. I hope she's our business council chair and also chair of the faculty staff benefits committee, which has saved us from problems on numerous occasions with her awareness of what's going on.
I appreciate that, lovely.
As well as Associate Dean of the Library, I'm sorry. Your real title.
I'm happy with the Business Council Chair.
Excellent.
So pleased to be here today. I was re-elected to the as Business Council Chair in January. My first order of business was to schedule meetings. We've had two successful meetings. One was canceled weather issues, and we have another one in May. The Business Council, for those of you who may not recall, consists of the Budget Committee, the Campus Development Advisory Committee, the Faculty and Staff Benefits Committee, the Government Relations Committee, and the Information Technology Committee. So, Budget Committee. So the Budget Committee has had some issues this year in terms of sort of finding its way and being able to get its members actually to attend. In fall of 2018, several meetings had to be canceled. There were some issues. In the past, I would say the Budget Committee has often had presentations from the Provost's Office, from HSC areas, and really looking at budget issues, but looking more behind. In consultation with Faculty Senate Vice President
Dr. Finney Coleman,
he met with the group in the fall and thought that he really wanted to have a more forward-looking approach and rather than reporting on past performance. So he was very interested in finding a workable solution to the salary compaction issues, the compression that's going on in salary across the campus, and so he asked the committee to look at that. He began looking at it this spring, again more meeting issues and so forth and so on, but basically they will be conducting a study. A member of the committee is going to be meeting with Barbara Rodriguez to determine what documents they can obtain to really look at this, and Robert
Gary, who's the chair of the budget committee, would like to have the project completed over the summer and then develop a plan on how to address the compaction issues to submit to the BLT for its fall meetings to really look at this in a very serious way. So that's really going to be the work of the budget committee over the next bit of time. However, Robert's term is ending, so the budget committee will be looking for a new chair for the fall semester. That's the reason why he's hoping that there could be some work over the summer so that everything doesn't just sort of break down and stop.
And Fran, I just want to add on that Jamie Chermak is on the committee, and she's a member of the budget leadership team, and Robert comes to all the meetings.
Right.
So they've had influence in that way.
Oh, absolutely. I have seen Robert at many of the meetings. I also attend to attend whenever possible because of the business comes on. Robert's been very active, and Jamie,
she's
just amazing. So, and moving on, the Campus Development Advisory Committee. So this faculty senate committee hasn't had a chair since previous chair retired in the spring of 2017. It didn't meet this last academic year. Again, working with Dr. Coleman, we're looking at ways of getting, you know, a full committee appointed. It had gone down to only two members as business council chair. I was going to hold the meeting to elect a chair, but there weren't sufficient members. But I think we now have sufficient members, and we're really looking forward to the committee beginning to meet again and get active once again this coming fall. So we're really excited about getting it going again, which would be great. Faculty and Staff Benefits Committee. Again, very active committee. It's a bit of a unique committee because it consists of faculty, it consists of staff, and it consists of retirees as well as ex officio members. And so truly it's looking across all of these issues for retirees, but primarily for active faculty and staff. It's a co-chaired arrangement. I'm a faculty co-chair, and we have a staff co-chair. Mark Bettolini is the staff co-chair. Carol Bernard had been the staff co-chair for several years, and she actually someone joked with her she'd gone over the dark side. Actually, she accepted a position with HR, and so that would have been so she wouldn't have been able to continue in the role. But it's good to have a colleague, so to speak, in HR, which has just been wonderful. So, the committee's major activities this fall was to understand and discuss the proposed new union medical plan for 2020. This is the one where Blue Cross Blue Shield and Union Team Health are merging populations and administrative services. And, of course, Presbyterian is staying the same, so no worries there if you're staying with them. The initial proposal wasn't met, should we say, with open arms in the fall because of the way that it was presented. It was quite problematic. We didn't feel we had appropriate information. It felt like a done deal without a chance to confer. However, throughout the fall, we met with HR, we met with folks from HSC, we really talked more deeply about all of this, and it does appear that we got a lot more detailed information, and it really does appear that it could improve access. It definitely will reduce the costs, including some co-pays. You've probably seen a number of these presentations, co-pays might have been $10 on average or whatever, but some of the other co-pays for certain kinds of things, like an MRI, those done right now, you pay about $600 for it. After the 1st of July, you pay about $150 for it, which is definitely a savings there. They're also looking to streamline some of the administrative costs on all this, which is again, we continued all conversations during the spring. The rollout, our main concern in the spring was the rollout, that it was really rolled out in a way that people could understand what was happening. So, you know, some departments, it was online and mailers, and they sent out recently. Got this in the mail, this brochure. This brochure is a handy-dandy version, and there's stuff all over the website. And they're going to have meetings on Valencia campus, the main campus, the Allen campus, the North campus, and Dallas campus, and the Bradbury location, and Salamos, et cetera, et cetera, to really help people understand how all of this will be working. And the average health care premium this year is going to increase around 5%, although this is bad. Nationally, it's actually higher. There have been savings in terms of UNM becoming self-insured, which happened a number of years ago. So on average, our health care costs are going up slightly less than the national average, so that's not good. The committee participated in the RFP process for the retiree post-65 health plans. I served on that RFP committee.
this resulted in adding plans such as Evan, Man, etc., at a lower cost and also more affordability. For those people who retire or are in other areas, there's a lot more network capability across the country for folks, and that was something that we'd heard very loud and clear in the committee and the staff benefits committee, so we're able to address that. I also participated in the RFP for the life and disability plans. This resulted in the Hartford being approved by the Board of Regents as previously the standard company. The plan design won't change at all, but some of the premiums are actually being reduced. So once again, we're trying to save money wherever we possibly can. It was also true on the post-65 healthcare that some of those premiums have been reduced as well. Some of them substantially. And this is really important to our retired population, those of us that may be retired in this life. We've been closely monitoring and discussing the proposed ERB changes that would be coming forward. We met on those on a regular basis. Because of time, I won't go into all the details, but there's information on the website on the benefits that are going to change with that, as well as on the New Mexico ERB site. Some of the highlights are changing the tier multipliers that take effect July 1 that will not affect anyone in this room, anyone currently employed. Those employed after July 1, 2019, when the changes go into effect. And there's some substantial changes there that you'll want to take a look at. They're also going to be increasing the employer contribution by 0.25%. There was a lot of confusion that this was happening to Aptis, to us directly, not so. It's actually UNM is increasing their contribution by that amount. It's going up 13.9% to about 14.15%. There's some anti-spiking provisions, and there's a whole variety of things that are on the website for some of the things. Sorry, no worries. Government Relations Committee. This committee worked actively with the UNM Government Relations Office. And some members also attended the UNM day. They got really good results. Pamela Pyle shares this Government Relations Committee. And I really want to give you kudos because your committee was amazing.
Well, thanks, Fran. Yeah, I told them. I bore them enough about it.
So I won't go into detail there. And then the IT Use Committee. It met three times during the fall of 2018. It's already met a couple times this year. There's another meeting planned that will be for May 2nd. The committee has a long-term agenda, which is including integration with the revised IT government structures. They've been quite successful at that in terms of facilitating shared governance while reducing functional overlap. Today, they've accomplished many things. I actually have John Mueller here today, who's the chair of that committee. With your
permission. Hi, John.
Is it okay if you
can? Yeah, sure. You want to share anything with it? I got to ask you to be quick, though. We only have half hour left for a lot of stuff.
Okay,
so come
sure.
Tell us what you can tell us quickly, and I'm sorry to be pushing.
And I'm going to go ahead and conclude my part of this.
Oh, thank you, Fran. Thanks for all your work.
Thank you, Fran. Yes, so I'll be brief that this year the IT committee has focused on two primary agenda items. One of those has been to work with academic technologies in terms of the ongoing RFP process for a learning management system migration or upgrade. We've got some folks on that subcommittee there. We're doing some internal analysis of use cases. The other thing is the FAR that the Vice Provost mentioned. We've been working with the Provost Office and discussing with them and Central IT what that application is, what is the justification for it, what are the use cases, and the main thing I wanted to mentioned today is that as we've been in conversation with them about that, we appreciate the opportunity and the transparency, but over time we've developed questions about the scope of this application, who are the users and the use cases, and where will the data be coming from? And in our assessment as a committee, there are sort of lingering questions about data governance and the policy requirement for how such an application would be developed and used. And so I have that we'll be distributing shortly a memo. It's basically a position statement from the IT committee, essentially addressing that will be shared with the Provost Office and the Business Council and the Faculty Senate, addressing some of our concerns about how the application will be structured and our concerns and expectations as faculty about data governance policies that should be implemented.
Has Duane received that well?
Duane and Rich have been very receptive. They've been in the committee every time we've discussed it. We have shared drafts of the policy with them. So, Rich was with us the other day, and I said, this is coming. There's no surprises.
Okay, good. No, thank you, John. Appreciate it. Appreciate the report. Thank you, guys.
Sure.
Thank you, Fran, for bringing your whole staff there. All right. Bob, the chair and professor of economics, Bob Behrens, who is a key member of the budget leadership team. In fact, I think people consult with him on the side about this. We had budget overload today between me and the president, but we didn't talk about new models and things like that.
Okay.
He's an expert. I told him to dumb it down for at least me. I'm sure everyone here is capable, but the guy's kind of a genius. So give us what you got.
Real quickly, it sounds like you've had a lot of budget stuff, and we all got to watch the short-term budget, the annual budget, play out yesterday.
Yeah.
And so I serve on the budget leadership team of the university. I have no idea how I got volunteered for that. For the last 7 years, I think I started about a month after it started. So it was an outgrowth of prior concerns about the lack of transparency around the budget. We created the budget leadership team about 7 years ago. It's chaired by the provost and usually the chief financial officer. It has about 20 people on it, the faculty senate president, student representatives, and we'll have four or five deans and then budgets, budget planners, etc. About 3 or 4 years ago, the BLT decided to implement committees and branch campus budget committee, etc. And I was asked to chair the long-term budget strategy committee. And then I also serve on the tuition and fee subcommittee, these subcommittees. So I want to talk about the long-term budget strategy committee today. I have one slide. Rick, if you could put that up. So we've been together for about 3 years, and for some reason everybody likes to go to this meeting. There's about 20 people at it. I forget all who's on there. Fran, I think you must be on there. Yep, and Pamela's been on there, and I have about four or five deans, etc. So we'll wait for that slide to come up. In the first year, we focused a lot on what we called the undergraduate value proposition, and we looked at modeling the relationship between the expenditures that are made on students and what students pay out of pocket. Many people might not know, but our students out of pocket, the tuition and fees for a year, what would you guess they pay? I'm going to guess it's lower than you think, and they pay about $2,200, and that's up from about $1,500. That's all tuition and fees for a year. The average student at UNM is about $2,200. We spend per student in your student-centered expenditure categories, that's instruction, advising, and student support, we spend about $15,000. That doesn't make us look like an R1, that makes us look like an R2. We spend a lot on less on instruction, academic advising, and support than the typical R1 does if you look at our competitive sort of position. So it's an incredible value proposition. It's about 10 to 1 or 7 to 1 or 8 to 1, somewhere in there. It goes up and down. So it's an incredible value proposition, and it's one of the reasons why the return on investment for students at UNM is so high. It averages about 10%, I think, annually ROI. So in the first year, we then modeled the relationship between expenditures on different categories and student outcomes. So when you hear people talk about, we graduate students at a higher level than you would predict given student characteristics, you also have to control for the level of expenditures. We econometrically modeled all that. I had some grad students from the econ department, et cetera. And just highlights of that, and there's a white paper that was out and circulated and used by the BLT. Highlights of that, spending on faculty always increases student outcomes. And that's all across all studies that I've ever done. But also spending on academic advising and student support.
Right.
Spending on other things doesn't necessarily, and often has negative effects, but spending on faculty. For the future, I want to talk about what we did this year, but for the future, we're planning, we've collected all the data working with enrollment management, and we're modeling, we're estimating demand models, and we're estimating how students respond to price changes, because we're having to raise tuition, there's concerns about enrollment. Economists call this price elasticity of demand. We're modeling, controlling for all characteristics, and modeling across all different market segments for that. We have a pretty good handle on that. And the handle is, it looks like it's always looked, they're highly price inelastic, given the fact that their net price is actually so low. What have we done this year? This year we were asked to look at three alternative models. I guess we don't have the slide, or we do have the slide.
Is it the one I just sent you, Rick? Or this one?
Okay.
It's not this one?
Okay. So we were asked to... We were asked to look at the budget model that the university used. So what is a budget model as opposed to a budget? A budget model, let's call it this. It's the set of institutional arrangements, rules, principles that you use at in a higher education institution that allocates resources and covers your costs. It's the way money flows in an institution, as opposed to, say, your business model, which is how you're trying to generate revenues and operating in a competitive market. It's like how money's going to flow in the institution. And there are about four or five hybrid models that are out there that everybody will talk about that. UNM uses what is referred to as an incremental-based budgeting model, and that means it's highly centralized. So what happens is all the money, so think tuition and state subsidy, it all pours into a big, what I call a fiscal commons or a common pool. And then it gets reallocated out from there. And most universities use an incremental-based budgeting model, but not all. And there are all sorts of hybrids. You can think of money of flowing in the opposite way. So that in the incremental-based budgeting model, who generates the money doesn't receive the money. It goes into the pool, and then it gets allocated out. You could think about just flipping the whole accounting system, and that's referred to as a responsibility-centered management model, or RCM. And about 30% of your privates and about 15% of your publics will use an RCM. An RCM just flips the whole thing. So if you generate the dollar, you get the dollar. And then the state-generated money would go into the fiscal commons. But the fiscal commons then shrinks from $330 million to $180 million. And all the colleges, if you generate tuition dollars, those tuition dollars all go to you. And then you build a tax and finance system on the top of that that then redistributes money back to cover those auxiliary services, student support services, et cetera, that don't generate their own money. So everybody wants to go to an RCM model. It's common to hear that talked about. And the University of New Mexico has explored RCM models for about a decade. So every 2 or 3 years, we look at an RCM model, and that's going to be the solution for us. Here are the downsides to RCM models. RCM models create a lot of competition because if I'm the chair of the econ, I suddenly want to start offering calculus and maybe Spanish courses, et cetera, in order to get as much money as I possibly can. So there could be a lot of competition. You now have all of this accounting layer that you didn't have. You have to blow up all your other prior accounting models, and you've got to generate all these new accounting models. And you lose the opportunity for sort of shared togetherness in trying to solve our problems, and you also, from the economist's perspective, you lose the opportunity for a lot of economies of scale. So through shared services and things like that, because every college is going to build out everything, right? And so there are downsides, and then there's this debate between these decentralized models, RCM, and the centralized models, incremental-based budgeting models. So my committee was asked by the leadership to come up with a solution to the current model. So the current model, this was the president's slide at the last meeting, and there are many more models than that. Think of all the possible hybrids in between. There are activity-based models, like how many students you have dictates how many degrees you generate dictates how much money you have, and performance-based models. Only thing I'll say about performance-based models, it's hard to allocate money based on performance when 10 out of the last 12 years you're having your state support cut. So you'd have to have double hits on top of anybody whose performance might go down. So we've tried to implement those, and we really couldn't. So the first model is our current model. They called it the state stasis. It's very centralized, incremental budgeting, and that's what the BLT is. Looking at that and then making recommendations in what we call an incremental base. So for every college or unit, auxiliary support, whatever, you're just saying, okay, last year you got $100 and this year we have 2% less and you're going to get 98. And so you just look at the increment or decrement. It could be a decremental based budgeting model over the last decade, right? And it was called Not a Good Plan, and I guess that's the plan we've been using. But what I'll say about that, why I think that statement was put up there, is that our budget model has large cracks. So we're used to have much higher state support. So here's what's happened to our state support. I'll try and be real quick on this. 11 years ago, you had about $190 million coming into main campus academic affairs. You've got roughly $190 million next year. 11 or 12 years later, the money looks like it's the same, but they were debating this yesterday at the budget summit. So here's the little problem, which took them a while to finally figure out. There's this thing called inflation. In the higher education price index, the inflation over those 12 years runs maybe 30%. So if you got roughly $200 million, you got 30% inflation, you have a $60 million hole. The other thing is then we've been raising tuition about 3.5%, and it basically covers that hole about halfway, and that was what Rich Wood was talking about, that $24 million hole we have. It's the combination of the decrease in state support and then the increase in tuition. Those two put together, that makes up what's called the fiscal commons, or what I call the fiscal commons. That fiscal commons sits today, or 11 years ago, sat at about $280 million and sits today in the 315, 320 range. If it was stayed even with inflation, it would be in the low 350s, and again, that's the $24 million of hole. So the problem with our business model is enrollments, demand has been shifting to the left, our costs have been going up due to tuition, etc. State support has been going down, and yet, to the credit of everybody in this room, you doubled your graduation rate during that period of time, and you're now hitting above your prediction given the expenditures you're making. The problem is we can't sustain that level of expenditures. And we know that the relationship between those expenditures is what drives student success and outcome. So we really have to wonder whether we can continue with the same sort of increases. I'll try and be quick here. Just stop me whenever you want.
I think I only have a couple minutes, honestly, because I got to get to the policy.
I'll just stop. So number two was the RCM. And the general consensus out of the committee is we didn't want to go down this path. We've looked at this for 10 years. Number three is where they say these are under consideration by President Stokes. Strong support behind number three. Number three is a sort of moderate decentralized fiscal commons. Notice that there was an arts and sciences differential tuition, what they're calling directed tuition. So that's very different than the typical centralized to give arts and sciences directed tuition. So the idea here is that you're taking some money, and rather than having that money flow into the fiscal commons, you're shrinking the fiscal commons a bit, and you're allowing more monies to start flow out and act and have the deans and those chairs and faculty act a bit more in an entrepreneurial fashion. There's more to that, but that was the sort of first step towards what would be a new model.
And many departments do this already. Many are professional.
What's different is you have your large arts and sciences with a differential tuition. You're really opening up the door then for differential tuition. The last thing I'll say about differential tuition, the important thing to understand is I call it untaxed. It's not exactly true because you got a banner tax and a foundation tax on it. The differential tuition is largely untaxed dollars. It doesn't go into the fiscal. And the tax rate on a dollar that moves from tuition typically into the fiscal pool at UN is about a 30% tax rate. So that's what's funding everything else. So if other things don't cover their costs, and there have been things like athletics and continuing education and the press, et cetera, then those just get covered through those implicit taxes, et cetera. If you direct dollars around the fiscal commons, then those go directly to student outcomes. And we want dollars moving to student outcomes. So this is the attempt, in its essence, to move to allow us to take a couple of steps away from an incremental-based budgeting model. This will be a multi-year process to try and implement this. And I'll stop with that and take any questions.
Any questions? There's a lot to know, I know. But it's interesting, right? It's just the first case. I mean, maybe we'll pursue this next year. It sounds like you should be our budget chair, though.
I don't know how I got volunteered for this.
It's dangerous to have talent. Yes.
So we're in a situation in my Department of Architecture where we took on, I think we doubled our student body because there was some understanding in my shared belief that we would be shifting to a responsibility-centered management model. Because we've been talking about it for a while. And we're in a moment now where it's really detrimental to our quality of education. It's incredibly detrimental to our facilities. We have floated in faculty meetings, perhaps we shrink the student body because we're literally letting anybody in. There's no requirement. And it's, in fact, dangerous. We have students who are not able to perform in the third program.
So
my question is, can we shrink without, and my chair has said to us, no, we can't shrink the department. They're going to hurt us. They'll cut faculty lines.
So here's the essential problem. The essential problem is that our current budgeting model doesn't link resources with activities.
I know, yeah.
And so all of you, and myself included, are always left in this conundrum. Do we grow? Do we shrink? Whatever we do. If you don't link resources to activities. RCM comes with problems and would create this very competitive situation, and it's maybe not really the way you want to go. There's a lot, a year of debate on that. We've looked at this, and it's time to say, okay, let's move past this. But we're trying to find a sweet spot where we take more dollars out of the fiscal commons and link them, to direct them to colleges and allow them to be then directly link resources to activities. And hopefully that will minimize some of these sorts of problems going forward.
So my question would be, I guess, as a follow-up, would you just say we should just keep performing in this way, or should we...
I don't know. I haven't looked at the specifics, but what I would say is you do have a differential tuition, and I think it's time to revisit your differential tuition. That every 2 years, those can come up for review. And the signal happening here is that the university has opened this door towards greater use of differential tuition. And so right now, you're really talking about maybe 5% of your tuition flows are flowing out of differential tuition. And you're going to have to figure out, we're going to have to look at how we calibrate in the future. Maybe that goes to 15%. Maybe that goes to 20%. Under RCM, it's 100%. But with those revenues comes responsibility for all the costs, right? Which means there could be losers. That's the other side of an RCM. So if your enrollment goes down, you lose, and there's no lifelines unless you can build it back to a tax and finance system. We think this approach here, kind of moving from 5% to 10% to 15 to 20, is a more incremental calibration approach that helps to try and minimize the problem you described.
You guys, I'm going to have to wrap it up. Take his email. I hope it's enough of a teaser for you to want to be more interested in the budget. But thank you, Bob, so much.
Sure.
We did give you 15, but thank you. I know you could go on for hours.
No problem.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
We're trying to get everything done. It's our last staff meeting of the year. Kim, come up and talk to us about your policy. Kim Gatterman from History, and she's the chair of the policy, co-chair of the policy committee.
So good afternoon. I'm here to present a policy, C290. It's a new policy. The policy committee recognized that there was no policy to ground the ombuds office for faculty. There is a policy for the ombuds office and staff. So what we did is we took information from the faculty handbook policy, C09, ombuds dispute resolution services for the faculty brochure, the university administrator policy 3220, ombuds services for staff, and we got input from the ombuds person for faculty. The policy that you see has been reviewed and has been endorsed by Jean Spickley Powell, who is the ombuds person for faculty. It went out for 30-day comment, and there were no comments. So
that's unusual.
Yeah, they were diverted by other policies after comments. I asked that the Senate please.
So any questions?
Yeah, any questions?
Yes. So does this allow for faculty to kind of step in between if there's some sort of problem with the student or something like that? They can utilize the services. Is that part of that faculty handbook, or is this...
The ombuds office, as we put into our policy, right, ombuds services continue to be voluntary. They are confidential. No records are kept. No permanent records. So this is a service that faculty could use if they wanted to have mediation.
But it's not a requirement.
No, there is no requirement. Ombuds service, both staff and faculty, is never a requirement.
Another question I thought I saw hand up. No? Going on?
Yes. Didn't have a budget? Is there an increase for a budget? Or
no.
Faculty just...
This is not, there's no budget attached to the policy.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I'd like a motion to approve number, is it 260? I turned my page.
It is 290.
290. Thank you. Second? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Any abstentions? Please fill out your ballot. This is number 15. We're on 15. Thank you very much. Okay, I've got one more action item I need your attention for. So, as I mentioned, in perseverance to more honestly cling to the Open Meetings Act, we are every year, to as a body, determine or vote upon the most reasonable amount of time necessary for notifying the public of our meeting. The minimum amount of time is 72 hours. I can tell you, sitting in this chair, I wouldn't want it to be more than that. Things happen at the last minute. I can get a region at the last minute. If we said, oh, let's do it a month in advance, we just sit here looking at each other talking about last week's news. So I would like someone to make a motion. I'm assuming perhaps it should not be I, that we are in agreement with the current policy, which the regents also use, of a 72-hour meeting notification. I'd like a motion in a second, and then we can discuss that. Yeah, thank you. And a second.
Second.
Thank you very much. Any discussion? Any questions on that? Okay, let's take the vote. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Any abstentions? Now fill out your ballot. Number 16. I do feel like I'm a sort of bingo game or something. All right, just let's get this through. Old business, new business. Anyone have any thoughts, questions they'd like to share? Yes, Tracy.
So I'm speaking on behalf of several of our Gallup colleagues today. With regard to the April 30th meeting that is coming up,
yes,
it's scheduled at an incredibly awkward and inconvenient time for branch faculty.
I'm going to turn you to Sever, who's the head of COG.
And I know you've heard from Dr. Ain, you're going to hear from several others. We teach a 5-course load. So not a 2-2, a 5. Mm-hmm. I have 2 classes on Tuesday, Thursday alone. Back to back.
Oh, I hear you, Tracy.
So I can free for my afternoons to come here.
Yeah.
Most of us do not have classes on Fridays. Yeah. Maybe labs, maybe the career tech.
You're wishing it had been on a Friday.
Is that
what you're
saying? It's been on a Friday so that we can participate.
I see. Okay.
I brought emails.
No, we understand the situation, Tracy. You don't have
to
prove it. Yeah. It sounds very difficult.
We're really ticked off.
And that's it for all the branches.
I mean, we're coming a long way.
Yeah. No, we understand.
2 hours each way. And at a time, what are we going to do, cancel our classes?
No, I hear you. I'm guessing they had a good reason to put it at that time because that was the only time they could get the hall. But let's.
I will reply as soon as we don't have all the questions.
Nancy, go ahead.
So something that I've been thinking about, and this is because I've been very active in my professional association, is that we allow for teleconferencing. So say, for instance, even if you cannot physically be here through some kind of phone call where you can actively hear everyone, you could participate. That doesn't solve the larger problem.
My classes are at that time.
Well, I'm saying in general going forward, I think it would be good to offer that in addition to dealing with when is the best time to offer.
Okay, just because we only have a little time left and people will leave. Sever, tell us.
To reply, and in fact, I was known to reply the committee has asked us to reply before the issues or concerns. We had some unbelievable restrictions in scheduling this particular meeting. If you look at the bylaws, the meeting has to be presided by the president of the University of New Mexico. And it was presided by President Schmidley before President Stokes today, or Tuesday. The meeting has to take place in Pope Joy Hall because it's the only place on campus that accommodates close to 2,000 people. Pope Joy is incredibly hard to schedule. There were 2 dates coming to have this meeting. We needed to be able to get the 72-hour notice. We also needed to prepare for the meeting given all the negotiations that are going on with the community. And we work really hard to try to see how we can accommodate everybody. This is the only day we could have, but we did not have any problems. So
by everybody, you mean everybody on main campus, but not the branches.
I'm sorry if you misinterpreted it that way. This is the best we could come up with to schedule the meeting. In terms of having a teleconference, we talked about it. This is actually only an informational meeting.
So
this is only this is a discussion meeting. We don't have a resolution to vote on. When that comes up, if it'll come up next semester, we'll try to accommodate some more. We have discussed maybe having it on a Saturday or Sunday. We somehow members felt that was not appropriate. The Fridays before didn't work for us, and this is the only time we found available.
Sever, will it be filmed? I was paying attention to something else. I'm sorry. Is it being videoed?
Okay. It will be recorded.
Our voices are not heard in that recording.
I'm not trying to defend Sever. I hear your thing. I guess no matter where we put it, there'll be a body of people who cannot
consider Fridays.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Yes.
Tara, go ahead.
Just curious. I just thought it's... recorded so people can listen more.
I'm glad you brought
Wait,
that
Sever,
up.
I think she was still finishing.
Oh, sorry. So one, I think recording would be helpful.
Yeah,
so even for people on main campus with like the Sciences Center, it's like none of us can go in our department and talk to.
Yeah.
So it's really hard. So I think that if you offer the ability to have it recorded and then some sort of response from people.
I think she's suggesting that there could be an opportunity for the branch campuses and the Meza School to respond to the recording to COG. We could send you their information. Their responses, in other words. Even though they couldn't be addressed in real time, maybe that would be something.
And then the other thing is a Zoom meeting is an option, too, for people who can't come in.
We looked into the possibility it's not a good work with this particular meeting. If you read the bylaws, the meeting is a general faculty meeting, and you have to have 10% of the voting faculty present at the meeting to take up in place. And we considered all these things. We didn't have enough time to go into all the logistics to see how Zoom would work. Zoom takes a completely different way of educating people.
Right, because we do that for our general surgery faculty meeting. We can't all be there. And also, I'm just curious what the attendance level is going to be. We're actually going to get 2,000 people that require
to be involved. We are prepared
for that.
And we may get 500 people.
Okay.
May not get it worse. Just to answer your question, yes, you will have the opportunity to ask questions. Please email them to me. What we will do, we compile the questions and we'll present them to the committee. If you need to make, the only thing that you will not be able to do is make comments in the open meeting. And, you know, our constituency is 1,980 voting faculty people, and we vote for best compromise we could come up.
So they could submit.
We realize it's a compromise.
Sever, they could submit questions then.
Any questions? Yeah.
So they could submit ahead of time questions, and then you'd hear them. I mean, it's something. Tracy, I hear you. I have to wrap up the conversation because we're not going to solve it today. So I'm sorry.
After the meeting, I'll talk to you some more. And believe me, we thought about these concerns. We discussed 3 days before we even decided which way to go.
Okay, guys.
I recommend that
you
come on a Saturday or Sunday.
I know people would.
Doesn't seem like
I know.
The appropriate way to do it.
I know.
So,
Sever, I'm so sorry. Thank you. I'm sorry to put you in the crossfire, but you do have the answer to that question. I just need to pause for a public comment. Is there any public comment today? We're at the end of the meeting. Okay. A motion to adjourn our last of the semester. There's not a vote on that. Is that a motion to adjourn? Give me a second.
I don't have a spot.
All in favor, but we don't have to vote on it, apparently. I mean, we have to record this one. Thank you. Happy rest of the semester and summer.
Drop off your slips with Dennis right outside.
Slips. Jason, take mine. What'd you think? I have to say and talk to someone. What was it? 8? What you sent me? 8, 88, 89, 91?